Blog Talk Radio.
Take a licking. There is someone waiting who will hurry up and rescue you. Just call for Super Chicken.
Welcome to the Backyard Poultry with the Chicken Whisperer Radio Show, brought to you by Tractor Supply, where we give away more chicken coops and chicken-related prizes than anyone else on the planet. We are often imitated, but never duplicated. My name is Andy Schneider, but most know me as the Chicken Whisperer, author of The Chicken Whisperer's Guide to Keeping Chickens, and national spokesperson for the USDA Biosecurity for Birds program. Today is Thursday, September 5th, and I would like to thank all of you for tuning in this afternoon on Blog Talk Radio. This is a live radio show that is broadcast around the world. This radio show is all about keeping backyard poultry, show poultry, and living a self-sufficient lifestyle. Each week, we welcome experts in their field to share their knowledge about different topics, including backyard poultry, show poultry, heritage poultry, gardening, cooking, and living a self-sufficient lifestyle. Be sure to visit our website. It's brand new, chickenwhisperer.com, where you can follow us on Twitter and become a fan on Facebook. Once again, I would like to thank all of you for tuning in to Backyard Poultry with the Chicken Whisperer, brought to you by Tractor Supply.
Ware Manufacturing has been building quality hutches since 1983. Ware manufactures modern chicken hutches, barns, pens, and nest boxes designed especially for the backyard flock. Ware offers hutches and pens for every yard size and every chicken keeper's budget. Visit their website at waremfginc.com. That's waremfginc.com, or call them to find a retailer near you at 1-888-824-7257. Ware Manufacturing.
Introducing the Chicken Fountain, a new way to water your flock. The Chicken Fountain will change your life and keep your chickens healthier by providing clean, fresh water every time. No more daily cleaning of dirty chicken waterers. This semi-sealed system keeps every drop of water fresh and clean. Proudly made in the USA, the Chicken Fountain will provide your flock with fresh, clean water for years to come. To order your Chicken Fountain, visit chickenfountain.com. That's chickenfountain.com.
Mount Healthy Hatcheries has been a hatching tradition for over 80 years. Home of the healthiest chicks, Mount Healthy Hatcheries offers a wide selection of bantams, turkeys, guineas, ducks, pheasants, and of course, meat birds and layers. Order online at mounthealthy.com. That's mthealthy.com, or give them a call at 1-800-451-5603. Don't forget to ask about their free bonus chicks offer. Mount Healthy Hatcheries, home of the healthiest chicks.
When you need an incubator, think Brensey, the incubation specialist. Brensey has been a world-leading manufacturer of incubators for over 30 years. Incubators from 7 to 380 eggs with high-quality electronic and digital controls, including precise humidity control and programmable egg turning, all at surprisingly affordable prices. Visit them online at Brensea.com. Brensea spelled B-R-I-N-S-E-A. That's Brensea.com, or call 1-888-667-7009. Enter the coupon code WHISPER at checkout and save 10% on their incubators, brooders, egg handlers, and other incubation accessories. When you need an incubator, think Brincy, technology you can trust.
Hi, I'm country music artist Nathan Osmond, and you're listening to Backyard Poultry with the Chicken Whisperer.
And the mighty bird against prejudice continues his fight for law and order. So when you hear that cry in the sky, you'll know it's Super Chicken.
Alrighty, thank you very much for staying with us today on Backyard Poultry with the Chicken Whisperer. We've got a great show lined up for you today. We've got poultry scientist and professor Dr. Bridget McRae, PhD. She's going to be talking all about genetics and breeding, so you can leave me out of this one because that is way above my pay scale. And so it's going to be interesting to see what she's going to share with us today about genetics and breeding poultry. And so get those Chicken Whisper notebooks out, because if you're anything like me, this is a new territory and probably a little bit over my head. So it's glad to have the experts come on like we always are. I hope you're having a great week. It's been a fast week. I can't believe tomorrow is already Friday. But yes, Friday will be here very, very soon. And are you looking forward to the weekend? I know that we are. And how about that? So we do hope you have a great weekend this weekend. I want to send a shout out to all of our homeschoolers that are listening to the show. Thank you very much for incorporating this show into your daily curriculum. There's a lot of you, and we appreciate every single one of you. Also, the over-the-road truck drivers, keep the rubber on the road. Thanks for hearing you. So thanks for sending a shout out when you can, when you're not hauling that freight all over the country, and we appreciate your emails. How about you live listeners out there? Thank you very much for tuning in live, and the thousands, that's no exaggeration, of archive listeners that listen to the show, iTunes.com, podcast.com, Zoom.com. We thank you too very much for listening when you can every day, 24/7. And last but not least, all of the feed and seed stores across this great land that stream this radio show live for your customers. We thank you very much for doing so, and so do our sponsors. So it's going to be another great show. Get those Chicken Whisperer notebooks out and ready. Gotta love it. So I posted some more chickens in the news over on our Facebook page and yesterday, even after the show. And I hope you had a chance to go over there and take a look at some of those. We shared one yesterday on the radio show where a chicken had eaten an earring, a diamond earring, from one of their owners. And basically the vet said, well, we can do very, very, very risky surgery for the chicken and try to get the earring out, or you're just going to have to wait until she dies, and then we can do a necropsy and get the diamond out that way. But, you know, the average chicken lives, you know, can be up to 8 years, some even 12 years, and the oldest living chicken on record, Guinness Book of World Record, was 22 years old. So that was here in the U.S., and that chicken just had to be put down about a year ago, but you can look that information up. And we posted that. What would you do in that situation if the earring fell out and the chicken gobbled it up, or pecked your ear and gobbled the diamond right off of your ear valued at $500. Yep, that's where they're saying this diamond was worth, $500. What would you do? Would you say, well, you know, hey, it looks like it's time for the crock pot. Going to have a good fried chicken dinner? You're going to say, well, hey, you know, you made a bad decision by eating my diamond earring, so guess what, crock pot for you. Or do you wait? Do you check the droppings every single day for the next 8 years looking for your diamond that may have popped on out and gone through the digestive system? Or maybe it's going to be stuck there in the gizzard and that diamond's going to be used as grit? That's some expensive grit. Oh, man. What would you do if that was your chicken? Would you eat it and go and look for that diamond? What would you do? So a lot of different comments. Some people were like, I eat the chicken, you know, replace it. Of course, the mom's like, I've got a daughter that loves her chickens. And some people, I guess, maybe they don't have chickens, were like, I just replace it with another white chicken with a red comb. She'll never know. Come on. you know, I think the girl would know. So different things like that. They're like, oh, it looks like a run-of-the-mill chicken just because it's a white chicken with a red comb. You know, just, oh, it looks like just a run-of-the-mill chicken. Just replace it and eat that one and get your diamond back. So, but anywho, some people were like, oh, my chickens are well worth more than $500 to me. So I could never do that. So, but interesting. Yeah, I posted that on our website yesterday. Curious what you would do in that particular situation. And then, of course, we posted another one we might have touched on yesterday on the show about don't trust a chicken nugget that visits China. And I posted, I'm sure many of you don't eat chicken nuggets anyway, but now they can come from China, which does not have to meet American food safety standards. So you might want to think twice before ordering those or buying those chicken nuggets. A lot of comments on this situation on that post. It was shared many, many times, 110 times here. It was shared throughout Facebook. So very interesting, a very popular post. And, you know, just recently there were some chicken jerky dog treats apparently that were recalled that were made and purchased in China, and some claim thousands of dogs lost their life to those. You have the melamine or whatever it was, and our vitamins apparently from China. You had all that sheetrock that came from China that was making people sick down in Florida a few years back, and all this stuff that's coming over from China. We've got this honey, fake honey that's coming over from China. Many of you have seen that. In fact, the article states or claims that the USDA lifted the ban late Friday afternoon before the big holiday weekend, hoping that no one would see it, that they lifted this ban and now chicken nuggets can come from China without any food standards or regulations whatsoever. So I encourage you to head over to our Facebook page and take a look at that. Think about that next time you bite down into a chicken nugget. So you can get all of that over on our Facebook page, facebook.com/thechickenwhisperer, and still hovering around 70,000 fans there on Facebook, more than any other chicken-related Facebook on the planet. So gotta love it. So one comment in the chat room was, well, I guess it depends on if it was a hen or a rooster, what I would do. And maybe if it was a roo and you had too many of them, it would be an easy decision to call that rooster and get that diamond. So, very interesting. So, Christmas Chick has some good questions in the chat room. Are you supposed to ask every time you go out to know where that chicken comes from? I think a lot of our food now is posted or labeled where it actually comes from. A lot of the fish will say from China or Asia. I know the fruit does. When you look at that little label on the fruit, I was looking at some oranges actually this past week, and I know for a fact one group of oranges in the grocery store were from Africa, and then the other one, I want to say it may have been from Peru, but I didn't find, of course. And, of course, it's still a little early for oranges here, maybe out in California, but it's still a little early for oranges from Florida, but it was interesting. So, yeah, read your labels when you go to the store and see where your food really comes from. Somebody had posted about even a lot of canned goods coming over from China and what's actually in those canned goods. I saw last night online that there's a yogurt recall, not an official recall. They're not doing an official widespread all-inclusive recall, but there's a yogurt recall, and it's I can't even pronounce it, the Chobani or whatever it's called, Greek yogurt, Chobani or whatever it's called, Greek yogurt, and most of it was, I think, produced in their plant out in, I want to say it was Idaho, but check it out. You can Google it, I'm sure, and try to find it. It's for very recent, last couple of days, and you can check the numbers on the lid. Apparently, they're contained a mold that was very common in dairy products that was very interesting. And but they said they weren't going to actually do a widespread national recall, official recall on it. They're just kind of a voluntary recall, letting you know that if your yogurt numbers printed on the lid have this series or sequence, then you probably want to fill it out, and we'll send you some more coupons for some more free stuff. So that made some of their big fans kind of angry, like, you know, well, that's all you're doing. You know, tell us what, you know, tell us this, tell us that. They're very, not necessarily being secretive, but just limiting the information that they're giving. They're saying, hey, if it has this number on it, probably want to throw it out. That's all they're doing. It's not even an official recall. It's just more of a maybe a protective measure, if you will. But so just if you didn't see it, just wanted to let you know if you happen to eat that yogurt. We do buy that yogurt on occasion. And but we checked the labels actually this morning, woke up and checked the numbers, and ours is not included in that recall. Thank goodness. So, but check your yogurt if you happen to eat the Chobani or whatever it's called, however it's pronounced regarding that. Yeah, mandarin oranges, oh my gosh, the amount of those that come from China are crazy. You're right, Christmas chick. And Christmas chick says she lives in Florida and she never sees oranges from there. That's like here, you know, I think technically California is the watermelon capital of the world, but we produce an awful lot of watermelons here in South Georgia, and you're right. You know, if you're a new listener, you haven't heard this. If you're an older listener, you've heard this before. I went into Publix one day. This was about 4 years ago, I think it was. And I walked into Publix, and I talked to the manager. I said, and he happened to be a friend of mine. I was like, what gives? What is this issue? I go over here, and I see your watermelons, and there's $7.99 a piece. You know, for Pete's sake, your watermelons are $7.99, okay? Number two, they're labeled from Mexico. Now, you've got California, and Georgia. Do you realize how many watermelons are grown in Georgia? Just right down the road, 3 hours down the road? Do you realize what a watermelon weighs and what shipping must be on all these watermelons? No wonder they're $7.99 if you're getting from, you know, California or Mexico. What gives? You know, they're right down the road. In fact, I had just gone to the farmer's market in Cordele, Georgia, in South Georgia. It was right after the 4th of July, so I guess the watermelon popularity had declined a little bit, but wasn't that far after. Okay, 90 cents a piece. They were $7.99 in Publix, 90 cents a piece. Maybe a dollar a piece, depending on if they were seedless or not. But it was crazy. 90 cents. I was buying them directly from the farmer that had hundreds, if not thousands, on the back of his trailer. Okay? 90 cents a piece. Picked that morning. Okay? So I asked him, I'm like, what's up with this? Well, the reality of it was there is a man or a woman. There is an employee, let's put it that way. There's an employee that sits behind a desk, and their job is to buy, he's a purchasing agent, I guess, and he buys, and if he can make one phone call to one person and stock all of his stores, or maybe all of his Southeast stores, or maybe a different area, you know, region of stores with one phone call, with watermelons, you know, hey, Jim, I need, I've got 200 stores, and I need, five crates of watermelons per store, blah, 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 can you handle that for me? Yeah, no problem. Okay, thanks, bye. Okay, he's done for the day. You can mark that off his list because he can call one person and get all of his stores instead of trying to, you know, say, okay, well, this farmer, even though I can get them for 90 cents instead of $6 a piece, and we can sell them, I guess, for $7.99, I'll have to make maybe 6 phone calls trying to stock my stores with watermelons instead of just one call, that's all, I'm done, coffee break, time to go smoke break, time to go home, I'm done, that's it, regardless of the cost. I don't care if they're from Georgia or Mexico or Africa or Venezuela, it doesn't matter, I'm done with my work. And so that's the answer I got from Publix, is that there's a dude sitting behind a desk, if he can make one call and he's done for the day, okay, I'm done, he's going to do it. Even if it costs you $7.99 a watermelon and not $2 a watermelon or $3 a watermelon, because they can buy them from 90 cents or maybe even less. I mean, 90 cents was me buying 3 or 4. You know, imagine if you wanted to buy 1,000 of them, what the price would go down to. So that was the deal I got from Publix, is that it basically comes down to one dude trying to get out of the office early, and he can make one phone call and stock all his stores, and great, that's what he's going to do. Pretty crazy, huh? So I was buying them for 90 cents, and everybody else at Publix was buying them for $7.99. I bet you mine were better because they were picked that morning right here in South Georgia. Mm-hmm. All righty, let's get over here to the phone lines. We've got poultry scientist and professor Dr. Bridget McRae, PhD, and we're talking about poultry genetics and breeding. something I know absolutely nothing about. Don't get into genetics. Don't get into the breeding portion of it. And so this will be new to me. So hopefully she won't ask me any questions because I'll just sit there with my dumb look. Correct answers are a dollar. Incorrect answers are 50 cents. And dumb looks are free. So we'll have a lot of free. So,
yeah,
hey, Doc, how you
funny.
Doing?
I'm okay. How are you?
I'm doing pretty good. So glad you could join us in a very interesting topic, way above my pay scale, I can tell you that right now. So everybody's got their notebooks out, I'm sure, wanting to learn about genetics and breeding.
Well, I did want to make a comment on one of the things that you put up on your Facebook page about the diamond.
Yes,
and the chicken.
Yes.
I thought that was just the most interesting thing. You know, we have a problem with chickens undoing our shoelaces when we work with them sometimes, you know, though, because your shoelaces move when you walk, and that's very attractive to chickens. But I have
toenails,
seen them go
toenails.
Out after.
Yeah, don't they love your toenails when you have flip-flops on? They got to come over
you
and check your toenails.
If you have shiny things on your feet, like shiny metallic things on your flip-flops, and I never really put two and two together that they would actually eat something that hard. And, you know, I worry about that poor bird. That x-rays, you know, you're going to have to check frequently, or every time the bird goes to the bathroom, you might have to comb through it. Oh, that's a lot. What an interesting story. You find the most interesting things sometimes, Andy. Good for you.
Exactly. Got to keep my followers happy. Yeah, I thought that was the first time, I think, in 5 years of doing the show and whatnot that I saw something like that. So
yeah.
Well,
I mean, it may have happened in the past, but people don't, you know, shout it from the rooftops through the internet like they do today.
Okay. So is it possible, based on that article, that it could stay in the gizzard forever, and or is it more likely that it would pass?
The metal might get ground down, because from what I saw in the picture, it looked like it was a diamond stud earring.
Mm-hmm.
And I honestly only glanced through the article. The
right.
metal would probably get ground down, but, you know, diamonds are the toughest things in the world. Chicken's not going to grind that away in its gizzard.
That's expensive grit.
I'm not sure I would ever put that back in my ear. Oh, golly.
Yep, I don't know.
But, yeah, it's rather unfortunate. It could stay there, theoretically, if it were too big to leave or it, you know, it never ground down. And if it did move on through the rest of the body, there's a chance that it could block or get stuck again or any number of things. But good luck to the owner. That's all I can say, really, is good luck to the owner.
We wish him luck.
Yeah. Well, yes, today I'm going to talk a little bit about genetics and breeding, Andy.
Okay.
And I know some of your listeners dabble with show poultry, and this is probably more directed towards them, but I think the rest of your listeners will find it interesting, simply because some of the information might surprise them a little bit. About its relationship to commercial industry, or at least laying hens, at least.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm going to talk a little bit about how commercial industry is set up so that you can kind of get a context as to how we figure out some of the heritabilities and that sort of thing. So when you look at breeding of poultry, the three main groups that we're talking about are meat chicken breeders, laying hen chicken breeders, and turkey breeders. Those are the three main poultry groups in the United States that have, you know, big breeding programs. Of course, there's ducks and a few others, but, you know, those are the three that usually come to people's minds first. The breeding program usually is based upon a pedigree, so they pay attention to great-grandparent lines, grandparent lines, parent stock, which... at least in in the broiler terms, we call those broiler breeders. And that filters down to the actual broilers that we eat. So there is selection, a great deal of intensive selection, especially at the great-grandparent and grandparent lines. Those are lines that are kept under strict biosecurity. If those chickens come down with sick with something, somebody loses a job, basically.
Right.
There's a much larger number of generations of chicken that have been subjected to intensive selection over other livestock because there's rapid reproduction. A chicken lays an egg a day. They hatch in 21 days. They're sexually mature by about 20 weeks, if not a little bit sooner, if it's a laying hen. And so you can really make change happen quickly, and I know we've talked about that in the past, Andy.
Yes. And
breeding and genetics is dominated by a few large international companies because they can afford to maintain these grandparent stock lines, make selective choices, hire geneticists, maintain the facilities in a biosecure manner, and do the research so that they can follow on down with these crosses and these matings and these pairings and these selections to make a decision of what, 10 years from now ends up on your dinner plate. That's what they're basically looking many years down the road. So it costs money to do that.
Mm-hmm.
We take advantage of hybrid vigor. So sometimes you cross in a bird that doesn't look like the rest because it adds a little something. It's called heterosis or hybrid vigor. So closed grandparent or great-grandparent lines, sometimes they do produce a cross in there just to experiment with what happens. And, they do that with turkeys and laying hens as well. I did, use broiler chickens as an example, but it's intense selection. They want to see what they can get and follow those lines down. So the chicken genome is 39 pairs of chromosomes. That's the chicken genome. 8 of them are large, 30 are small. And then there's the sex chromosome. So you said not to ask you any questions, Andy, but I'm sure you know this one. In humans, XY chromosome is male or female?
I got to go back to my high school days. That's just something that doesn't come up when you've got a 2-year-old and you're living life out here on the RV road. So.
You've got XX and XY. XY male or female? Maybe
male.
Your listeners know. Yes, it's male.
Male?
Male. And so
50-50.
XX is female. Well, it's switched in poultry, and we don't use XY. We use Z and W. So ZZ is the male, and ZW is in females. And that's something that poultry or birds have in common with reptiles. Reptiles are the same way. ZZ is male, ZW is female. With turkeys, there's 41 pairs of chromosomes. Also part of the reason why, they look so different. There's more going on there. It's a relatively small genome, the chicken genome, that is. It's about 20,000 genes, and when you look at that, it's about 1.2 billion base pairs per haploid genome. And they've mapped about 2,000 of the loci, and they know a great deal about the genetics of the chicken. Lots of early research in poultry genetics focus on the color. Color was the endpoint. When you cross this bird with this bird, what did the progeny or the offspring look like? And they found out that lots of genes control feather color in chickens and turkeys. And most of the economic traits, like egg laying, growth, rapid growth, that's on multiple genes. So, you have to think about, all right, We want a white chicken, but we want it to grow fast. Or maybe you're doing show chickens. You want a Colombian Plymouth Rock. You're going to have to learn about specialty of your particular variety as it relates to the genetics of that color. Some things that we figured out, you know, Gregor Mendel found out that, you know, you crossbreed peas and other flowering plants and you've got the foundation of genetics. Well, William Bateson came along and was able to, with the use of chickens, determine that Mendelian genetics can be applied to animals. So it's not just about plants that these rules apply to. And he did it with chicken combs. He figured out that the rose comb gene is dominant to the single comb gene, which is really kind of cool. A lot of breeds out there have single combs, and that is, you know, that just using something as easy to see as a chick hatches out as a chicken comb. Growth rate is really a highly heritable trait, and we've been able to get chickens to grow rapidly, hence the broiler chicken. And, you know, three quarters of the improvement to the broiler chicken has been done with genetics. And I still, to this day, get a lot of guff from people. It's the hormones in the feed. No, we've been doing this for almost 100 years now. It's genetics that's made these rapid changes in these birds. That's why the broiler chicken looks so different from the Cornish chicken, the Cornish bird. Let's go back to combs. Both the rose comb and the pea comb are dominant to the single comb. And when you cross a rose-combed bird and a pea-combed bird, you get something that's in between. An in-betweener comb. We call that the walnut comb. And feather color. Feather color is based on multiple genes. Like, for example, white in the white leghorn is dominant to color plumage. So a bird that has a feather pattern. So if a white leghorn is mated to a colored bird, the next generation will be all white. The dominance of the white in the leghorn is because there's a gene that inhibits color or pigment formation. White is not always dominant, however. So that was just an example with the leghorn. Okay. It depends on the genes that are controlling the dominance and where they sit. An example of inheritance, let's look at two characteristics that can be obtained when you cross birds, like a black Wyandotte and a white Plymouth Rock. So one has a rose comb, that's the Wyandotte, and one has a single comb, that's the Plymouth Rock. So you're dealing with combs and color types, feather color types. And remember, the rose comb is going to be dominant to the single comb. All of the first generation crosses, or the F1 crosses, from that mating, they're going to be rose comb and black. But the next generation after that, the F2 generation, they'll have 9 rose comb blacks, 3 rose comb whites, 3 rose comb blacks, and 1 single comb white. So it's a 9-3-3-1 ratio. So if some of your listeners out there have young people who are really interested in poultry genetics, that might be something where you get started with some birds that you want to experiment with and do a school science project. That's what I'm trying to get out. You might try getting that cross, and if you don't get exactly what I just described, maybe the birds weren't pure that you received. So it might be something fun that people can do for a school science fair project. Okay, talk a little bit about examples of dominant and recessive characteristics in chickens. I'm focusing on chickens. Oops. Sorry if you heard that. I just dropped a pile in my office. I just knocked something over. So if you look at barred feathers, and a lot of people think of the Plymouth Rock first, and don't you have a listener who's barred rock?
Yes,
I think you do.
Ah, so, yeah, up in New England.
So in Plymouth Rocks, barred plumage is dominant to non-barred plumage, and that's a sex-linked trait. Black feathers are dominant to recessive white feathers. Broodiness is dominant to non-broodiness, and that's a sex-linked characteristic. And remember how we talk about the single-comb white leghorn is not very broody? Well, we've bred that. We've expected her to be not so broody, and we've ended up breeding that in. Buff plumage, so that golden caramel yellow color, that's dominant to recessive white plumage. Close feathering. Now, not everybody may be familiar with the term close feathering. If you look at how tightly feathers are held to the body, or how loosely feathers are held to the body, it's either loosely feathered or tightly feathered. So if you think of a loose feathered bird, a lot of people will first think of the Cochin, big, fluffy.
Mm-hmm.
And the opposite of that, a close feathered bird might be a modern game, very tight feathered or close feathered bird. So close feathering is dominant to loose feathering. Early sexual maturity is dominant to late sexual maturity, and that is a sex-linked trait. Feathers on the legs are dominant to non-feathered legs. And so some breeds, when you're crossing to create new color patterns, you have to be careful with that, because the stock that you pull from might be a feather-legged bird, and the breed that you're trying to create shouldn't have feathers on the legs. So you'll have to, you know, start selecting those birds out. excuse me. There's a growth hormone receptor that can be changed so that you have something that's sex-linked and related to dwarfism. And the growth hormone receptor is dominant to the mutant receptor. Again, that's sex-linked. So you can get birds that are significantly smaller than other birds. We talked about the rose comb being dominant to the single comb, and side sprigs are dominant to a normal comb. And a lot of people in their breeding programs, they have to select out birds that end up with side sprigs if they're showing, because side sprigs are bad. You don't want to show a bird with side sprigs. And that's just a point on the comb that comes off the side rather than where it should be down the middle. So you should know your breed and what side sprigs look like. And they can be really quite small. You have to be careful when you're examining them. Going back to plumage, silver plumage is dominant to gold plumage, and that is sex-linked. Slow feathering is dominant to rapid feathering. White plumage in white leghorns is dominant to color, colored plumage. And white skin and white shanks, the shank color, is dominant to yellow skin and yellow shanks. So folks who are out there showing chickens, they know the challenges that you can get when you start breeding a new line or pull in somebody else's line and start doing some crosses or line breeding. And sometimes you get surprises. You didn't know that that line carried such and such an aspect. All of a sudden, all your offspring have side sprigs. Well, shoot dang. You're going to have a lot of birds to cull. So going back to the skin and shank color, I found this something that some of your listeners may find interesting. The different shank colors found in chickens result from different combinations of pigments in the upper skin layer and the lower skin layers. And so yellow shanks are due to the yellow pigment from xanthophylls, carotenoids, pigments, in the epidermis, and the absence of the melanin pigment. And, you know, when we get out in the sunshine and we turn a little tan, that's melanin pigment. Black shanks are due to the presence of melanin in the epidermis. White shanks are due to the absence of both pigments. And having shown burns myself with mostly white shanks, you know, you do look carefully that there's no yellow that shows up if you get new stock or no slightly green color to it. I thought I would talk a little bit, Andy, about feathering, the rate of feather development, because I think your listeners have talked about this in lieu of vent sexing. A lot of people would prefer to know how to feather sex. And it has to do with the early feathering gene. And I'm going to talk mostly in relation to broilers, but, you know, when we talk about male and female and early feathering gene, you have to think about what industry uses this the most. So it's a recessive sex-linked gene, the early feathering gene, and the sire has to have that early wing feathering gene, and the dam has to have the late wing feathering gene. When you cross them, when those chicks hatch out, the male chicks, the sons, are late feathering like their mother, and the daughters, or the pullets, are early feathering like their father. So, if you think about it, mom gave her traits to the boys, dad gave her traits to the girls, and a lot of people have a hard time keeping track of that in their head, but the sire has to have the recessive trait, the mother has to have the dominant trait in order for that to work. So how do you know what that looks like? Slow feathering versus fast feathering. Well, when your chicks hatch out, you pull out one wing and you're going to notice that there's the primary feathers starting to grow. And also, at the same time, you've got the wing coverts growing. And, you know, not all chicks have this as obvious as others. It's clearly been defined and refined in broiler chickens. So in the male chickens that have inherited the trait, their wing coverts are always as long as or longer than the primary feathers. That's the boy chickens. And then the girl chicks, their wing coverts are always going to be shorter than the primaries. So feather sexing chicks can go rather rapidly if somebody is just, you know, pulling out one wing and deciding is this a boy or a girl. It goes a little bit faster than, say, vent sexing. Although some vet sexers are very good and very fast. But you don't have to have special training necessarily to make those determinations. Another way to do feather sexing, rather than the length of the primary feathers or the wing coverts, is the color of the chick when it hatches out. And this makes people's lives even easier. baby chicks can be identified as either kind of white, silver, or kind of a goldish red color on their down feathers. The gold color is recessive. That's the gold that I had mentioned earlier, the gold plumage. And that is used as the male. And the female has the silver, which is dominant. And that produces white chicks that are male and gold colored chicks that are female. And this is quite often used in the egg laying strains, so you want to keep those females that are gold colored and not so much keep the males, which are more of a silver white color on their down color, because you're going to keep your egg layers for eggs and the males you don't need. Now, if you are working on great-grandparent stock lines or grandparent stock lines, you still need to keep track of, you know, which are males and which are females, and how many you're going to keep back to test new lines or to propagate lines even further. How are we doing on time, Andy?
We're doing just fine. No worries. No, okay. Ahead of schedule.
Oh, okay. Do you want to wait until 1 o'clock to do a commercial?
We can go ahead and do one now. That's perfectly fine. No problems with that. And then we'll come back and you can get on to the rest of the topic. No worries. Thanks.
All right, folks. If you're just tuning in, we are having the pleasure of having Dr. Bridget McRae, PhD, on, and we're talking all about poultry, genetics, and breeding. Well above my pay scale, know absolutely nothing about it, not my forte whatsoever, so I'm learning right along with you. It's just fascinating, but a lot of our folks and fans that show chickens and breed chickens here or take advantage of today's show, whether you're listening live or the archive, great information. So, and we'll have so much more from Dr. McRae when we return after this short break. So stay with us, folks. Won't be long.
Established in 1957, GQF has become the name to trust when it comes to quality products and superior customer service. GQF offers a wide range of poultry products, including incubators, brooders, feeders, waters, and much, much more. Give them a call at 912-236-0651 or visit them online at gqfradio.com. That's gqfradio.com.
Pictures of chickens on aprons are common across America, but picture a chicken wearing an apron and you'll probably get a good chuckle. Laugh if you must, but nothing protects hens better than the Hen Saver Hen Apron. Hen Saver Hen Aprons protect your hens from the damage caused by an overly affectionate rooster and may even provide protection from an unexpected hawk attack. Hen Savers come in several different sizes to fit both bantam and standard-sized hens and roosters. Colors include camo, denim, navy, brown, khaki or black, and soon pink. Crazy K Farm is expanding its already colorful Hen Saver collection to include the color pink. A portion of their sales will be donated to organizations that fund breast cancer research and awareness. Order your Hen Saver aprons today at hensaver.com. That's hensaver.com.
Ideal Poultry has been a family-owned and operated business since 1937. Their business is built on customer service and quality poultry. From rare white and brown egg layers to broilers, ducks, turkeys, and bantams, Ideal Poultry is the largest supplier of backyard poultry in the United States, shipping close to 5 million chicks annually. Visit them online at idealpoultry.com. That's idealpoultry.com.
Do you provide a heat source for your backyard chickens in the winter? In most cases, it's not necessary. But if you choose to provide a heat source for your backyard chickens, it's imperative to use a safe and effective heat source, and the only one I recommend is the Sweeter Heater. The Sweeter Heater is a safe, completely sealed, washable, non-breakable, energy-efficient, long-lasting, and reliable specific area heater that comes with a 3-year warranty. Ditch the dangerous heat lamp this season and invest in the only heater I recommend, the Sweeter Heater. Purchase the Sweeter Heater online at sweeterheater.com. That's sweeterheater.com.
Hi, I'm country music artist Nathan Osmond, and you're listening to Backyard Poultry with the Chicken Whisperer.
Hey, it's the Chicken Whisperer, here to tell you that if you have backyard poultry, nothing is more important than making sure your feathered friends are safe from infectious poultry diseases. Learn the simple steps to keep your birds healthy by visiting this website, healthybirds.aphis.usda.gov. That's healthybirds.aphis.usda.gov.
A message from the USDA.
Alrighty, thank you very much for staying with us today on Backyard Poultry with the Chicken Whisperer. It is the first Thursday of the month, which means we are very fortunate to have Dr. Bridget McRae, PhD, poultry scientist and professor here, and today she's talking about, yep, poultry genetics and breeding. Learning lots of great information. I know you are, all you breeders out there and folks that show and are trying to get just the right color, just the right bird, just the right beak, just the right comb. All this, I'm sure, means an awful lot to you when you're breeding. So, Dr. McRae, we're ready to continue.
Well, Andy, I think in your chat room you had a question from Christmas Chick. She actually asked several questions. She has black copper Morans and would like to add blue copper Morans and splash Morans to see what they get. You know, each one of those has its own chapter on color genetics. So when you start to get into feather plumage genetics, you had better get your notebooks out. And I am not kidding. I deal strictly with white birds with my programs because, you know, when I was in 4-H, I had bearded white Polish and white Orpingtons because I didn't have to worry about lots of those details. And when I get to the end of this talk, I'll share with Christmas Chick and the rest of your listeners, oh, my goodness. There's a good book out there, but you got to want to learn it because it gets detailed. There are people out there who are really good at their particular color genetics and experiment a great deal, but they have the resources, the pen space, the amount of room in their large incubators and the interest in doing this, and it's not for everybody. Some people, you know, just getting a few birds from Murray McMurray is all they really want. So I fully realize this topic isn't for everyone, but you can go really delve really deep into this if you want to. Okay. When we talk about egg production, so that perhaps some of your listeners have a greater appreciation of the eggs that they buy at the grocery store or the eggs that they get from their laying hens, egg production can be affected by a lot of different factors, including feed efficiency, the housing that you provide the birds. But when it comes to genetics, the feed efficiency can be affected genetically with your breeding program, the number of eggs produced in laying period. Early sexual maturity is heritable at about 30%, so that lowers the cost per egg. Egg size is 50% heritable. That means mom passes that along to her chick 50% of the time. It's a highly heritable trait. Egg quality is heritable. So, you know, shell color, texture, strength, shape, on the exterior quality, interior quality, lack of blood and meat spots, amount of thick white, proportion of white to yolk, those are all heritable. And those are all things that geneticists, poultry geneticists look at. It's a good job to have. Shell color is heritable. We know that certain breeds produce brown-shelled eggs and other breeds produce white-shelled eggs. The intensity of lay is only about 10% heritable. Now, what intensity of lay is the number of eggs laid by a hen during her peak production. So if your flock of chicken peaks at 85% production, that means the average hen in your flock is laying an egg, on average, a little bit more than 8 out of 10 days. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Okay. And, you know, you want to aim for a high intensity of lay, but it's only 10% heritable. Hatchability, that's 12% heritable, so the percentage of fertile eggs that hatch under artificial incubation, that's hatchability. Broodiness, when they're laying eggs, they're not broody. When they're broody, they're not laying eggs. So when you're in a business, you need birds to lay eggs. You're not paying them to sit around and do nothing. You're paying them with feed, of course. Broodiness has been reduced in laying chickens, But it's still there in bantam chickens and turkeys, but a little bit there in like broiler breeder chickens. We've really worked hard to minimize that in egg-laying chickens. The weight of a broiler chicken is a highly heritable trait. That's about 60%. So we've made a lot of progress in selecting the largest birds at broiler market age and making sure that selection is has changed the bird that makes it to your plate. Growth rate has about 30% heritability. That's different from the weight of the broilers. Feed efficiency is correlated to growth rate. Excuse me. Obviously, chickens that don't eat as much or convert it to muscle as well don't have as good of a growth rate. Now let's talk about dwarfism. Hens that carry sex-linked dwarf genes are about a third the size of normal birds, normally sized birds. But their egg size is only about 8% smaller. So if you look at this from the laying hen point of view, these are smaller laying hens, smaller body maintenance requirements, increased feed efficiency, and you only lose about 8% on egg size. And so there have been, you know, researchers who play around with that for the egg laying end of things. And there are other researchers who've looked at the broiler end. And when it comes to the dwarf gene, you know, body size is reduced by about 30%, but there's only a slight reduction in the growth of the progeny, the next generation, about 2 or 3% in growth, reduction in growth to the market age. They're also hatching from smaller eggs. So, lethal genes. I think I may have mentioned that, or at least people who run in show circles have heard the term lethal gene from time to time. Certain abnormalities, certain heritable things in certain birds may be caused by what are considered bad genes. So all lethal genes are recessive, and they can remain hidden for lots of generations. How do you prevent that? Well, what basically happens is the embryo dies before it even hatches out. The prevention of these abnormalities require that you have to go into the background of the birds and see if you can't trace back somehow where this came from and eliminate that line, which isn't easy if you're giving up something that you love or a line that you enjoy a great deal. So it's recessive, and that means that the breeder has to look at both parents. That means they both carry the gene for these lethal genes. It's recessive. When you're breeding birds, some breeding programs are going to require you to do some inbreeding, and that's when you mate closely related flock members, like brother to sister. And you do this for successive generations, so that you get what you're looking for, whether it's body type, feather color, comb shape, eye color, or combinations therein. Sometimes you'll bring in somebody else's genetic line if you feel like after several years you're not getting anywhere with your efforts, or you want to make a dramatic change or shift, or just want to play around. Then you bring in somebody else's line, and you get heterosis or hybrid vigor. That's when your crossbreds to this new bird outdo the average productivity or whatever you're measuring of the parents. So a lot of people will say, oh, you always end up with healthier dogs on the street because they're just the hybrid vigor. They're breeding on their own, versus some breeds of dogs that are highly inbred, show dogs maybe. So hybrid vigor does have value, and it can be measured percent-wise. So consider that if you're getting nowhere with your breeding program, you can consider going out of your normal line and finding somebody who's got a line that has an attribute that you want to add to your own and invest. So going back to great-grandparent stock, a lot of those companies you've heard me talk about when I refer to research papers, what lines of chickens they're working with. Sometimes I'll say they're Ross or maybe they're Cobb, or if they're laying hen birds, it might be an Issa bird or a Hubbard bird or a Highline chicken. Those are all primary breeders. They have great-grandparent stock and some grandparent stock. So those are some of the names that are associated with great-grandparent stock. And, of course, they breed down to provide eggs to hatcheries and multipliers. Those hatcheries and multipliers end up producing some grandparent stock to maintain the lines and the parent stock. The parent stock, or the broiler breeders in the case of broilers, they provide, there are certain farms, fewer farms with fewer birds that lay lots of eggs. Those eggs go to the hatcheries, are hatched out, and there's your broilers or your layers or your turkeys that those farmers then grow up and they go to the processing plant and are sent to your table. So occasionally you might end up with a farm that is done with their broiler breeders or their parent stock, and they'll send them to the same processing plant, and they're slightly older, and they might be about the size of a roaster. And so sometimes something that's the size of a roaster might be sold to you, and it's an older bird. It's a larger bird. Mm-hmm. But not all roasters are parent stock. I'm going to make that clarification right there. Thinking about methods of mating your chickens, if you're thinking about setting up pens for your own breeding experiments, if you've got a big breed, a heavy breed, you've got maybe one male in with 8 to 12 hens. If you've got a light breed, maybe say Leghorns, you'll use one male for about 15 to 20 hens. And he's not necessarily going to be the same male that you use all breeding season. You might switch him out after a while, and I'll talk about some of the details on that in keeping track of your records. But young males are more active than older males, and you typically don't necessarily use for commercial birds a male that's over 3 years old. So age is a factor in how capable he is in covering the females and making sure that every egg that they produce is fertile and likely to hatch. If you are selecting and culling your chickens, you're looking at probably keeping no more than 25% of your birds. If you're really being selective and you're really paring down and keeping the top of the top, you might only keep 10%, 10 to 15%. So you have to know what you're looking for, what you're willing to keep and experiment. And remember, by culling the birds, you may be able to process those birds and sell them or find an auction or a swap to sell them at. I know that there's a swap this weekend up here in Smyrna, Delaware, at the Delmarva Poultry Fanciers Club's, the show superintendent. He has a swap the Saturday after Labor Day every year. And there's a lot of waterfowl that shows up there. So if anybody's in the area and you're listening to this broadcast this Saturday, get there before noon. And the earlier you are, the better. Get there at about 7 or 8 in the morning, and I think you'll see lots of birds that may tempt you. And a lot of waterfowl as well, although you never know what people are going to bring to a swap. Okay, now that I've gotten off on that tangent, I will go back to poultry breeding and genetics. But those people are getting rid of birds that they've, you know, probably hung on to since they hatched out in March or April. Or they might be getting rid of old breeding stock that, you know, they're done with and somebody else can enjoy them for a while. Okay, how to improve egg layer genetics. Annual egg production is the most important selection criteria for egg layers. That doesn't mean that you can't pay attention to the other things like egg quality, feed efficiency, body size, overall health and vigor, livability. That's what I mean. But you want to primarily select for annual egg production. So if you've got a whole group of brown-shelled egg layers mixed together and you don't know who's laying what, you might want to invest in something called a trap nest. And you can find those online, and they're just a little insert, but you can't pick up your eggs twice a day. You have to be out there every 30 minutes, because once the chicken goes in there to lay the egg, they're stuck in there until you let them out, because you're going to write down on the egg what hen it came from and keep track of those as they go into the incubator, so you can follow the productivity of that bird and who she's been mated with. They also have trap nests for turkeys as well. So the more characteristics that you select for, the more difficult it is to make change. So selection of two or more characteristics, that cuts down on the effectiveness of your ability to select for any single one of them. And keep in mind, annual egg production, it's a low heritability, about 20%. So you really need to focus on that. A lot of people talk to me about, you know, going back and to the White Plymouth Rock and to the Cornish and remaking the broiler chicken, but with colored feathers, to meet the demands of a different market than the grocery store market. And gross rate broiler chickens reaching market weight has about 35 to 40% heritability. And meat chickens as well as turkeys, you know, you can, because they're a rapid gross rate, that's a savings in labor. So the faster they make it to market weight, the less time you spend with them, the less labor involved, the less cost, the less feed consumption, and there's also lower overhead and production costs. So if you're thinking about starting a meat chicken business, you want your birds to grow quickly because it costs less. They're more efficient. And I know a lot of your listeners out there have bought birds or invested in locally raised, but I don't think enough farmers actually factor in their labor and maybe perhaps underprice their product a little bit. Okay, let's talk about programs for keeping track of your birds, because it can get kind of hairy if you've got a lot going on in your farm. If you are doing pen systems where you've got maybe 10 pens, and each pen has, we'll say, White Plymouth Rocks. Okay, they all have White Plymouth Rock hens in it, but you have 10 males, and you want to switch up which males are in which pen. How long should you wait before you start collecting those eggs? Well, give it 2 weeks before you start saving those eggs and start marking them as the new male is the sire for that. And keep in mind, you only want to use the males that have pretty good fertility. And if somebody's not doing the job, first thing you need to think of is why. Why is his fertility down? Did you have a cold snap? Did his comb freeze? Did his wattles freeze? Is he in poor health? Any bird that's in poor health, maybe had a cold, should never be used as a breeder. Okay,
question,
so that's something to consider. Mm-hmm.
Question.
Go ahead.
I saw this on, it was either a blog or a forum, and so obviously grain of salt. But I thought when it came up, I would ask one of our guests, which would be you.
Armageddon.
Is a rooster infertile during molt?
No.
Okay. I saw that and I was like, I had my doubts, and I said, well, I'll find out. I'll know for sure. And that's okay, good. That for our listeners, again, I'm telling you, that was either on a blog or a forum.
He may not be at maximum fertility, but he can still produce sperm.
Gotcha.
So when you're collecting your eggs and you're writing down what pen it came from, you're going to write on the egg, but you're also going to write on a sheet of paper or put it in a book. You're going to always write at the small end of the egg because most chicks crack out at the large end of the egg, and you don't want to, you know, you don't want to risk losing what pen that came out of because you wrote it at the large end and the chick just, you know, obliterated that end of the shell. You might want to put hatching baskets together in your hatching tray. So that same little quarter-inch wire that you see in a lot of hatching trays, you can get that at any sort of hardware store. And taking care to remove all sharp points, you can create little hatching baskets, put lids on the hatching baskets, because those suckers will hop right out and jump into somebody else's pen, and you'll think, now I know I put 4 eggs in there, but there's 5 chicks. Where did this one come from? And they may all look the same, but their genetics are different. Then you want to label them with pieces of masking tape as to what pen produced those eggs. And when those chicks hatch out, you want to put little, you might want to do the toe punch method, where one foot represents the male line and the other foot represents the female line. And where you put the hole in the webbing of the toe represents which parent was the source, whether it was parent number Z73 or Q97 or Pete the Rooster. You might also, instead of doing the toe punch method, you might want to put little tiny spiralettes on your chickens, which are the non-numbered leg bands. And one leg could be for mom, and the other leg could be dad, and whatever color mom has goes on one leg, and whatever color dad has goes on the other leg. But you have to write all this down so you keep it straight in your head, or else very quickly you will lose your mind. And so those are, you know, little sheets that you keep track. Every time you have a hatch, you want to keep track of what hatched. Was the egg fertile? So you have to open up eggs that didn't hatch and find out if there was even embryo development, or was it just plain old infertile? You want to assign the number to the chick, what pen it came from, the day that it hatched, what color it was when it hatched out, because some of you work with breeds that have very distinct color patterns, what sex it was, if it's sex-linked, and any notes as the bird ages, what age you culled it or on what date you culled it. When it gets older, you want to take a look at them and say, you know, was there positive white in the wing and it can't have any white at all, or did it end up having a single comb and you're supposed to have a rose comb? You know, was there good lacing on the bird? Did it have good body type? Did it end up looking brassy and it's not supposed to? Other things that you could do is wing banding instead of leg banding. But again, that requires you to put a hole in the bird, and not everybody's comfortable with that. And wing bands, I think it's National Band Company that sells you a little wing bander and a set of wing bands. And again, you'll have to keep mating records. For each pen, you should have a mating record, who the males were, who the females were, and who their parents were, what color variety you were working with, what breed you were working with, the number of the pen, what year it was, because you don't want to get last year's records mixed up with this year's records, how many eggs went into the incubator, how many chicks came out, what the fertility was. You know, did you, what was your percent hatchability, how many eggs hatched out that were fertile. And, of course, those same notes about those chicks. Were they male? Were they female when they grew up? Bird number 57 might be a male, but, you know, before you actually culled the bird or kept it for your breeding program or show program, you may have found out that it wasn't a male, it was a female. So, you know, keeping track of these records will help you decide, okay, I ended up keeping 10% of my birds. Each bird gets its own page in this record. And keep track of how they do at the shows, what date the show was, where it was, and who the judge was. Could end up being that you've got a judge that really prefers your female line, while the judge 2 weeks later prefers your male line. That's something you may end up forgetting at the end of the year when you're trying to decide which males and which females to put together again. So you take your show cards from the front of your cage and you paste them into the book along with the date and who the judge was and how you placed. And so that's a way to keep your mating and your show records kind of together, and it will help you make a better decision at the in the fall and the winter when you're putting your breeding pens together again. So that's what I wanted to share with your listeners, Andy. Have I missed any questions in the chat room?
I was following that, and not that I can see. You caught the ones that were there.
I see one on Sharpies. Sharpies are okay to use. I like to use the fine tip Sharpies, and black Sharpies are just fine. They're easier to see on any color egg.
A bad characteristic coming out. I guess one time, I know scientists don't like to use the word, it's a fluke, but it's, for say, scissor beak. How many hatches, if I'm hatching out 300 at a time and get one or two, or if I'm just hatching 28 out at a time, regardless of what, maybe it's a bum leg, a lame, you know, When do I, the first time it happens, do I need to show some serious concern, or maybe, you know, is it two times?
If it happens once, it could just be a mutation. Uh-huh. But if it shows up in multiple years of your progeny, it's kind of like a progeny test. You may take a family or a line of chickens from your flock and really like that line, but if 10 generations later something starts to show up and you're like, oh dear, you're going to probably have to look back at your records and see if you can't make some changes to eliminate that problem. And it might be something where 1 year you've got, you know, 300 birds that you're hatching and 10 end up with crossbeak. That, if it came out of one particular line or one particular pen, I would pay attention to. But one bird... Mm-hmm. Anything can happen once.
Okay.
I think you've heard me say that a couple of times with regard to statistics.
Well,
anything can happen once. If it happens again. And then I see Christmas Chick has a question. Is it wrong to breed a totally different breed to get a characteristic in your original bird? And do you still call the new chicks by the breed name of the original breed? I have a friend who has rose combs, and to get some of the old rose comb colors back, she had to cross with Old English Game. And it's going to be several generations until you can call your rose combs rose combs again. That first generation is just going to be a cross, your crossbred, until you can start to get some purity in the offspring. And, you know, she's been working on this for 30 years. She's got black-breasted red rose combs, and she's got some darn good ones. But for several years, she had about 8 different varieties of rose combs, lemon blue, blue brassy backs. She ended up once with a splash, a red pile splash. So, you know, like I said, anything can happen once. But, you know, she had to really start narrowing it down and say, do I focus on my blacks, which is my foundation stock, and maybe one other variety, and that's what she did. She focused, and she started to win with this variety that has long since been gone in the Rosecomb breed, which is the black-breasted red or the BB red Rosecomb. So it takes time. It may take decades to get where you want to be. So be patient. It's not impossible, but those who are dedicated to color genetics are dedicated to color genetics. Okay. Any other questions, Andy?
I don't think so. I was just, like I said, wanted to thank you for answering that about the information online about, you know, first roosters are, because we're talking about breeding, and it's important to know, I guess, when, you know, if you get a lower hatch rate or something, maybe it's the molting season, and you're wondering, oh, how come only so many hatched here, there, or the other? But so they do not go completely infertile during the molt. Maybe a little bit less production, but not infertile. That's a strong word, so I wanted to confirm that up. And, no, great information. As always, love to have you on so we can get the right information the first time. And I knew this would affect a lot of our listeners, because they do. We do have a lot of show people that breed. And, a lot of
and
folks
for those listeners, Andy, who are really interested in poultry genetics, there's a very good book out there. It's by Fred P. Jeffrey. It's called Bantam Chickens. There are some spiral-bound older editions that have what looks like a silky chicken on it. I ended up with getting a reprint that's got a red cover on it. I really, really recommend it for those who are hardcore dedicated into color genetics or want to be. It's a good investment. Probably will cost you $30, $40 maybe. But we're not too far from Christmas. Folks can put it on their list. Bantam
Perfect.
Chickens by Fred P. Jeffrey, Jeffrey.
Awesome.
And you will know more than you ever wanted to know about. I mean, I think there's a good 100 pages in there just going through every single feather pattern out there.
That's crazy.
It's
crazy.
Intense. It is intense, but it is a fun adventure if you get into it.
I bet it
would
be fun and interesting.
Work that way.
You know, your chickens hatch out, and you're like, okay, let's see what we have today. As they grow and start to feather out, what do we have today? And,
but career-wise, for your young listeners, poultry genetics is a viable option. You can work for one of those bigger companies and really make a difference in what we see in our plates in the next decade or two.
I can tell you the giddiest, if that's a word, that I have been doing interviews in the last 5 years was at the International Poultry Expo in Atlanta last year. And when I was tickled to have the geneticist, I guess, if you will, the creator of their particular, from, I think he was from Belgium, of some huge mammoth company that was doing the ISA Brown,
mm-hmm.
and man, that was just it was awesome talking to him. I went over to, and they had one of the largest and nicest displays there, and I was over there just kind of a little peon that I am, and talking with him and wanting to set up an interview and whatnot, and for the guy to say just a moment, and then have this guy come over who their entire breed of ISA Browns that they particularly, you know, that they produce was, here's this dude, all about him.
Well, you can't say that poultry doesn't allow you to travel, because he came all the way from Europe.
Yeah, it was, meeting him was just an amazing, because it's one of my favorite breeds, and have impressed us over the years, so to meet him was just, was awesome. As, you know, like some people might be like, oh my God, it's Taylor Swift. You know, I was like, oh my gosh, just meeting this guy would be totally awesome. I love this breed. I've had, you know, experience with it. It's one of Jen's favorites as well. And here's this guy that comes from Belgium. This breed is all about him. I mean, it's his. So that was awesome. So it was very exciting for me. And when you go to the International Poultry Expo, so much of it is about genetics and breeding. It's incredible. all of the big companies that are there and all their science. It's just crazy. So more than just having a few backyard chickens with curtains on your nesting boxes, it's pretty intense, like you said. So, but hey, thank you for joining us. It's always interesting, always exciting when you're on. And though today's topic was well above my pay grade and my thinking scale,
that was just a glancing blow at it. Quite honestly, you can make a career of this.
Always interesting. So, hey, we look forward to having you back in a couple of more weeks, folks. Dr. McRae comes
Andy.
On the first and third Thursday. Thank you. And I wish you all the best in the next couple of weeks, and we look forward to having you back.
All right. Take care. Enjoy your chickens in the meanwhile, everybody.
Absolutely. Thank you so much. All righty. Always glad to have Dr. McRae on. And if you like her show, then, hey, make sure you put it in your calendar, first and third Thursday of every single month. That's going to wrap up another week of Backyard Poultry with the Chicken Whisperer. We will return on Monday. Now, Monday is questionable, folks, because Peter Bram, who comes on every Monday with Ask the Chicken Doctor with Peter Brown, is on the road this coming weekend going to a poultry show. And that can take a lot out of you. And so, believe me, knowing how it is on the road, it can take a lot out. So we may wait and have him on Tuesday instead of Monday, but I will let y'all know over the weekend. He's going to let me know probably Sunday afternoon when he pulls back in how he's feeling, how worn out he is, and whether we will have Peter Brown on that Monday or possibly next Wednesday. I believe next Tuesday we have the American Livestock Breeds Conservancy on, and so it may be next Wednesday. But nonetheless, we will keep you abreast of our schedule and your favorite guests when they come on the show here on Backyard Poultry with the Chicken Whisperer. So until Monday or Tuesday, we hope you have a wonderful, wonderful weekend with family and friends. And again, want to send another big shout-out and thank you to Dr. Bridget McRae, PhD poultry scientist, for another great episode on poultry breeding and genetics. So have a great weekend, everybody. Follow us on Facebook and on Twitter. In the meantime, God bless.